caught up in the electronic gadgetry down here. Thank you very much for your very warm welcome. And let me say what a pleasure it is to be here with you tonight. The last time I was on this spot, it was a parking lot, and I'm glad to see that the change has been for the better. It's a pleasure to see a number of friends in the audience, a number of my former colleagues from the University of British Columbia who are students with me are here tonight, plus a few of my former professors. So I would hope that they would join with me tonight, because it's a pleasure to be back here on the campus. What I thought I would do tonight is talk to you a bit about Western Canada and what I see for it in the future. And I'd like to start by commenting on the election of a Western separatist in a by-election in Alberta in February 1982 raised the specter of a strong separatist movement gathering force throughout Western Canada. And to many at that time, it suggested that the West was at some kind of crossroads, if not at a crossroads, rapidly approaching one. And if one looks at newspaper articles at the time or in various magazines, there are many comparisons with this by-election in Alberta and the election of the PQ in Quebec in 1976, and before that when they had elected a few members to the provincial legislature. For many people in Western Canada, the election, or the by-election, I should say, came as a great surprise. For others, it only confirmed their belief that there was a strong feeling of alienation throughout Western Canada, and that this particular by-election was merely the most recent manifestation of this. Others interpreted the by-election as a message for the federal government. Send them a message. Nevertheless, to me, this by-election, or single incident, brought to the attention of many people in Western Canada and others across the country that there was a profound feeling of alienation in at least Alberta, and if not there, in other parts of the West. However, the poor performance of the Western Canada concept in both the recent Saskatchewan and Alberta provincial elections suggests to me that separatism is not an alternative political solution that the majority of people in those provinces are willing to embrace. Rejection of separatism does not by itself mean that the problem of alienation has been overcome. To me, these are two separate issues. And it does remain, alienation that is, and could once again be channeled into some kind of separatist movement. So what I thought I would do tonight is explore with you some of the causes behind this recent wave of discontent and offer one or two possible solutions which might possibly overcome this question of alienation which I've already mentioned. Before looking at these causes, I think I'd like to give you some background of Western Canadian history to demonstrate that what we are seeing today is not necessarily a new phenomenon. Now, when talking about Western Canada, I think one must exercise a certain degree of caution. Western Canada, to most people, means the four Western provinces. And you can add to that, depending on your perspective, the Yukon and Northwest Territories. But while Western Canadians have many shared experiences, and we glibly talk about the West, it seems to me that one is on very thin ice to assume that Western Canada is a unified or homogeneous entity, or for that matter, that the intensity of alienation is a constant across Western Canada. So, having made that caveat that when I'm talking about the West, I recognize that, not necessarily everybody holds the same views. Looking at the past, I don't wish to be accused of making gross generalizations, but to cover all of Western Canadian history in a matter of minutes is difficult. I would argue that alienation and discontent have been evident throughout much of the 20th century in Western Canada, or in parts of it at one time. Indeed, if you go back even further in history and consider the Riel Rebellion, it stretches back into the 19th century. And transportation, trade, tariff policies, which were developed in the late 19th century, and which became known as the MacDonald or the National Policy, are part of the historical legacy of Western Canada. Indeed, you go to the Confederation debates and the commitments that George Brown, publisher of the Globe, wanted to bring. He wanted to bring the Western lands into Canada. And before he would give his agreement, his quid pro quo was the West, or then Rupert's Land, had to be brought into what was then Canada. And from that, of course, the national policy developed. The policies contained in the national policy were ones designed to protect and promote the manufacturing industries of Central Canada. The West, therefore, was to serve two purposes. One, it was to provide raw materials to the emerging industrial heartland of Central Canada, and it was to become, or to be, a captive market for the goods manufactured in Central Canada. And to use the sociological term, it was a hinterland. Now, if you look at the effects of transportation, tariff policies on Western economic development, again, one will find that there are differing opinions as to their total effect. But given the fact there was an effect, I'd like to set that aside, and the argument I would make is that despite differing interpretations, people in Western Canada believe that these policies have been developed and were injurious to their own interests. So it's part of the mythology that is found in much of the literature dealing with Western Canadian politics. Partly because of these perceptions, the sense of grievance and injustice, and partly for other reasons, such as the Depression, protest movements have been a common phenomenon in Western Canadian history. And most students of Canadian politics have heard of the UFA, the Progressives, Social Credit, and CCF. All of these have resulted and developed in the West. They resulted in part because of dissatisfaction with traditional political parties and or the operation of the political system. Both of these ideas, I think, one finds today. I'd like to return to that towards the end. To many, the Liberals and Conservatives, or the old line parties, were seen to be controlled by Central Canada and only to work for the benefit of Central Canada. These old line parties did not take the needs of Western Canadians into account. Now, whether these protest parties, and I think one has to think of them as protest parties in their origins, not necessarily today, but in their origins they were protest parties, and whether they were seeking office federally or provincially, they were established and had as part of their basis the idea of promoting or protecting Western Canadian interests. But despite their concern with policies as they had developed at that time, and because although they were deeply disturbed by the political system, none of these parties espoused separatism as part of their political platform. Their goal was to reform the political system, to make it more responsive to the needs of Western Canada. And I think when you look at the parties I've mentioned, they have been, from the time of their origin up to today, successful in the West. They have managed to run for and seek and attain office. Indeed, all four Western provinces have had at one time or another one of these parties as the governing party. Well, that's some of the political background. Another issue which has been a recurring one throughout much of Western Canadian history is what I would call the question of control over natural resources. To Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, the question of control over natural resources is slightly different than it was in the case of British Columbia. Because when Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta became provinces, in the case of Manitoba in 1870, and then as you look at the map of Canada, the boundaries of Manitoba expanded from a small colony near the border up to the 60th parallel. And again in 1905 with Saskatchewan and Alberta, when they became provinces, the title to the public domain and the resources under the public lands was maintained by the government of Canada or by the federal government. And if one reads the Saskatchewan and the Alberta Acts, which sets up these two provinces, one finds that the lands were kept, the title was kept for the federal government for, quote, purposes of Canada, unquote. British Columbia, on the other hand, came into Canada in 1871 as a crown colony and brought control with her over the natural resources. They belonged to British Columbia. But if you go back not too far in history to 1967, there was a question in British Columbia of control and ownership of offshore resources. And even today, I believe, there is a case pending before the Supreme Court of Canada on resources in the Georgia Straits. So the question of resources is one that people in British Columbia are also familiar with. That is the question of title. The federal government's continuing control over resources in the Three Prairie provinces was in part due to the determinants of the McDonald National Policy. And what were these lands or resources used for? And in effect, at that time, really, the concern was with control over public lands. Public lands were given to railways to act as an economic boost to get them to build certain lines. Lands were given to returning veterans after the First World War. And finally, in 1930, after a long and sometimes bitter dispute between the three prairie provinces and the federal government, title to the resources was finally transferred in 1930. And somebody might ask me later on, do you think that would happen today? Would they transfer title to the resources today? And my answer is unequivocally, no, they would not. And but in 1930, it was transferred. And the reason is found in the Natural Resources Transfer Agreement, and it is, quote, so that these provinces should be placed in a position of equality with the other provinces of Confederation with respect to the administration and control of their natural resources. It was to bring these provinces to the same level as the other six at that time. Now, from this brief historical overview, I think two observations can be made. One is that to many Westerners, national policies, and I put quotes around that, were not really national at all, but policies designed to benefit Central Canada at the expense of the West. The second is that Western discontent was such that protest parties had been formed to a great extent to represent Western interests. So that's a little bit of the past. I'd like to turn now to the present. And for the sake of argument, I'm taking the present as the past 10 years. 10 years ago, this coming January, about 10 years ago after the 1972 election, actually, the federal government proposed in the throne speech of January 1983 a Western Economic Opportunities Conference. And this conference was held in Calgary in the summer of 1973. And the agenda had, which was negotiated between the federal and provincial governments, had four key items: transportation, industrial and commercial development, agriculture, and capital financing and financial institutions. These four items, if you want to put them in a bag, I would call matters concerned with economic development. And if one looks at the proceedings of the three-day conference, there's no question that there was an underlying current of concern, frustration, and alienation. Indeed, this mood, I think, was captured by the Prime Minister in his opening remarks to the conference when he said, quote, "Lying behind our proposal," and that is the proposal to have the conference, "was the fact that so many gifted individual Westerners could feel so much discontent with their present and future prospects as Canadians." The Prime Minister also observed, quote, "When Westerners speak of alienation, I know they refer not solely to lack of economic opportunity. Many, at least, are concerned with lack of leverage in national decision-making. They want a stronger voice in national affairs." So these two themes, economic problems, which really was the subject matter of the discussion at that time, but also how to increase the Western voice in national affairs. And part of the thrust of the conference was to develop a new national policy, people having come to the conclusion that the old national policy of the 19th century had in fact run its course. Now, since 1973, some modest measure of success with respect to the matters discussed at that conference has in fact been achieved. Some examples are, and this would be familiar to people in this province, the development of the Prince Rupert port facilities, which are at least going ahead. Provinces, the western provinces, could play a greater role in the development of trade and tariff policies and participated, at least discussed with the federal government, the federal position at the GATT negotiations in Geneva in 1977. Greater accessibility to financial institutions. Calgary has now become one of Canada's more prominent or more important financial centers. So since that conference, things have moved along. But at the same time, this is something I will spend a fair amount of time on tonight, is the energy dispute. About 2 months after the conference concluded, there was a war in the Middle East, and that war precipitated what most people call the energy crisis. And this crisis, Canada was not immune from its effects. In the fall of 1973, the federal government froze oil prices at that time. I think it was about $3.80 per barrel. And for the first time established an oil export tax. And since the fall of 1983, energy as a question has been a subject of ongoing debate between the federal and provincial governments in Western Canada. Alberta, Saskatchewan, and British Columbia, the three provinces in particular, have been critical at one stage or another of different federal policies in this field over the past 10 years. Criticism in part, if not absolutely, has been because the provinces have defended their control over natural resources. It's not energy. Energy may be the manifestation of the debate, but the thing came down to control over natural resources. And throughout this last 10 years, the producing provinces have moved to, I would say, clarify, to strengthen, and more effectively exercise provincial jurisdiction or ownership rights over natural resources. I think one should think about this in two ways. One, the provinces as owners exercise certain rights, and provinces as legislators also affect the development of resources. All three producing provinces increased royalty rates to capture a greater share of economic rent that was accruing from the exploitation of natural resources at that time. They also introduced new marketing legislation and regulations and adopted measures to tighten their control over industry operations. That's what the provinces were doing. At the same time, The federal government, starting in 1973 in the fall, developed a series of policies in the energy field. And in the aggregate, these policies that have been developed over the past few years have been considered by governments in Western Canada as a bold attempt to wrest control over natural resources from the producing provinces. Now, what were some of these policies? I think it's important that we review some of them tonight. Now, clearly, I can't go into detail on all of them. I'd like to highlight a few of them. The first, starting in the fall of 1973, as I've mentioned, the federal government announced controls on crude oil exports and established the oil export tax. There had been, before that, a tax on electricity exports, but in 1973 that tax had disappeared. In fact, it disappeared 10 years earlier. These export taxes were to be temporary, but nevertheless were protested and criticized by Alberta and Saskatchewan, both of which saw the tax as an unjustified intrusion into resource ownership rights. 1974, the federal government established a national market for oil. To that time, if you go back to the Royal Commission on Energy, the so-called Borden Commission, Canada had been divided into two markets for oil. One western market, and the Ottawa River was more or less the boundary, and that from the Ottawa River to the Pacific coast was a market for western oil, and the eastern part of the country was a market for imported oil. And they erased the so-called Borden line and established a uniform market for oil, or crude oil, that is, across Canada. Western crude could now be marketed anywhere in Canada. Indeed, the Montreal-Sarnia pipeline was rebuilt. One footnote here, I think, should be mentioned. In the 1974 energy negotiations, the price at the wellhead was set at $6.50 per barrel. And when Premier Davis agreed to this price, he was under the impression that was the price landed in Toronto. They found out afterwards that the price in Toronto was about $7.20, and that there was a transportation charge tacked on to the wellhead price. And the paradox, of course, is that when one thinks of freight rates for the railways, there's the corollary of pipeline tariffs, which have to take into account to push Western oil eastward. And I can assure you that after that conference, my colleagues from the province of Ontario became very familiar with the difference between wellhead price and Toronto City Gate prices because of the transportation charges. 1974, the federal government also decided that the domestic price of oil, and this is a key Canadian policy, should be lower than the international price. Now, how much lower has been the subject of negotiation since that time? But the key policy is that it should be lower than the international price, and that the expensive oil imports were to be subsidized through the proceeds from the oil export tax. I mentioned the oil export tax earlier. It's established in the fall of 1973, but the proceeds from the export tax were just going into the federal treasury. It's only starting on April the 1st, 1974, that the proceeds from the export tax were used to offset the cost of imported oil. Also in 1974, the federal government enacted what I would call the first major piece of legislation in the oil and gas area. It's called the Petroleum Administration Act. There are two versions introduced. One in May 1974, where the government, as you know, was defeated at that time, and the act was reintroduced in the fall. The original draft encompassed only oil. The second draft encompasses oil and natural gas. So it's the second bill, which was introduced in the fall of 1974, had a much greater impact on the province of British Columbia than the earlier draft. I would call this a kind of omnibus energy bill. And to that date, it was the most significant federal energy legislation that had yet been contemplated by Parliament. And through this act, the federal government establishes the oil export tax, and it can also establish, and this is the key part of the act from the perspective of both Alberta and British Columbia, it can regulate the price of oil and natural gas entering into the interprovincial market. There's a section in the act which says that the governor and council can, in his opinion, just tear up an existing agreement. Those are not quite the words, but that's the effect. If an agreement is no longer considered to be effective, and it can establish the prices, it being the federal government, unilaterally. Although the act also assumes that prices could be set through negotiation. And indeed, between 1974 and 1980, the price of crude oil had been set through negotiation and confirmed through formal federal-provincial agreements. In 1980, and I'll get to that in a minute, the federal government unilaterally established the prices of oil through the National Energy Program. The fifth area of change was in the area of resource taxation. Perhaps the most controversial measure of resource taxation was the non-deductibility of royalties, which was introduced in the May 1974 budget. Again, that provision went out when the government was defeated, but it was reintroduced in the fall of 1974. And in the budget speech in the fall of 1974, I think if you read the document, you sense part of the dilemma, where the Minister of Finance at the time, John Turner, in his speech said he recognized that the West wanted its place in the sun. But the question of royalties and the increases in royalties to the federal government was destroying their corporate revenue tax base, and therefore they eliminated the non-deductibility. Some argued that it wasn't really a place in the sun that was being sought, but rather an eclipse, but that's another perspective. The Western provinces argued strenuously about this provision, and indeed were modestly successful in modifying it in the 1975 budget, where the federal government agreed to permit a limited amount of royalty deduction, but not as much as had been in place before the 1974 budget. The sixth factor is in a different area. I've talked about legislative action, I've talked about resource taxation. The other one is what I would call legal action. And this affected the province of Saskatchewan. In 1977, the federal government intervened in two court cases that at that time were taking place in the province of Saskatchewan. And there were constitutional questions being addressed in both cases. No one was arguing that the federal government could not intervene in the case to clarify the constitutional point. But in both cases, the federal government became a co-plaintiff on the side of the companies which were challenging Saskatchewan's legislation. And both the Premier and the Attorney General of Saskatchewan didn't argue the right of the government to intervene, but they did question the wisdom of coming in as a co-plaintiff. And Saskatchewan interpreted this intervention as highly unusual and took it as a direct assault on that province's economic development policies. Now, if you look at these policies individually, you may say, well, any one of them is not particularly detrimental to the interests of Western Canada. But collectively, over a period of time, they were viewed with increasing concern by the four Western provinces. And this continuing policy thrust on the part of the federal government was one of the factors which led to a creation of a committee of Western provinces that goes by a rather long name, the Western Premier's Task Force on Constitutional Trends. In 1979, the task force reported rather bluntly, quote, "Some of the most contentious issues in federal-provincial relations in recent years have been centered around the natural resource sector. Various federal initiatives, especially since 1973, have resulted in increased tensions between the federal government and the provinces, and in some cases have severely restricted the freedom of provincial governments to exercise their responsibilities over the management of renewable and non-renewable resources." So there's no doubt that the Western provinces were concerned with this continuing barrage of policy changes with respect to resources over the last part of the 1970s. Well, that was up to the National Energy Program. Now, the National Energy Program was introduced in the fall of 1980. And to the Western provinces, was seen as a direct challenge to their resource ownership rights, and it pitted them, the provinces, against in their ownership rights against the federal government's powers of taxation, their powers to control and regulate interprovincial commerce, and really the future direction of Canadian energy policy. And instead of tensions being reduced as a result of the development of a national policy, in fact, they were increased considerably. The NEP, if you look at it and how it was established, represented a significant change in how energy policy was developed in Canada. Before 1973, indeed, this is, I think, a subject that will be studied considerably in the years ahead, is how was energy policy developed? Up to 1973, there wasn't much discussion of energy. There had been a Royal Commission, a few studies, some concerns over electricity. From 1973 to 1980, there had been a series of federal-provincial conferences and negotiations. But from 1980, it saw the federal government develop new policies, which it developed unilaterally. The idea of a cooperative approach to national policymaking had been dropped. And it was a significant departure from what had, one might argue, had been developing throughout part of the 70s. What did the provinces do? The ministers from the three oil and gas producing provinces of Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia stated that the NEP was, quote, creating a crisis in energy security, and it would serve, quote, no other purpose than to divert revenue to Ottawa and attach the right to control resources and that the provinces have under the Constitution. The provinces believed, in effect, in short, that this was a major intrusion into the resource field. What did the NEP do? Now, I don't have time to go into the whole thing tonight, but some of the things it did were it unilaterally established the price for oil and natural gas without consulting the owners of the resource. Carved out significant new taxes for the federal government, including, for the first time, an export tax on natural gas. With the NEP, the federal government was seeking to control energy, to gain revenues, and to Canadianize the oil and gas industry. Alberta responded to the NEP in a number of ways. The first thing it did was it challenged the gas export tax on the basis that the tax was a contravention of Section 125 of the Constitution, which means that one government can't tax the other. And the case in question, the Smith-Cooley case, was a reference case to the provincial Supreme Court. The court upheld the question that the province posed, saying that they can't tax provincially owned resources, and the Supreme Court of Canada supported that conclusion. The second thing it did, and these aren't necessarily in order, was to cut back oil production in stages of 15% at blocks of 60,000 barrels over a period of 90 days. 60,000 barrels and another 60,000. And the third cut was to take place at the time that an energy agreement was concluded, but I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. Now, one can argue that this was very dramatic action for one province to take within the Canadian Confederation, because it did disrupt about 10% of Canadian oil supplies. The move, however, was tempered by two caveats established by the government. First, Alberta gave notice, 90 days notice, that cutbacks would be instituted. Secondly, as I've mentioned, the cutbacks were in stages. And thirdly, a commitment was made that should there be an emergency or a disruption in supplies, then production would resume. One might say, well, why cutbacks? What about supply at that time? This decision was made at a time when the government of Canada had concluded agreements with Mexico and with Saudi Arabia to purchase crude. But the agreements were made to purchase crude at the then prevailing world prices. So one could argue that the issue wasn't so much one of supply, that oil was available. The question was really, what was one prepared to pay for it? And thirdly, the provincial government withheld approval on the development of further oil sands projects. What did British Columbia do? The British Columbia Minister of Energy called the National Energy Program a, quote, blatant money grab, and instructed British Columbia Hydro not to pay the new domestic tax imposed on natural gas. Saskatchewan also refused to pay the domestic tax on natural gas. So that was the, if you like, the scene which preceded a year of negotiations. These events took place during the year, and with it, there was a surge in anti-Ottawa sentiment throughout Western Canada. A negotiated settlement was finally reached with Alberta on September the 1st, 1981, and a few weeks after that, agreements were reached with Saskatchewan and British Columbia. What were the effects on the oil and gas industry of the NEP? I think in summary, one could argue that the year of dispute had seriously hurt the oil and gas industry in Alberta and British Columbia. Drilling rigs left for the United States, and much of the expertise that had developed in the industry left with it. Recovery of the petroleum sector since that time, of course, has been further hindered by other factors. What are some of the other factors that have affected this? First of all, there was the ongoing uncertainty over what direction federal energy policy would next take. And as you may recall, there was a series of bills introduced last spring and finally passed in June of 1982, which really was the legislative output from the National Energy Program. But before industry would do anything, it needed predictability as to what the rules would be. The federal budget of November 1981 constituted a serious setback to risk takers in all sectors. This added further uncertainty. High interest rates affected exploration activity. Inflation, in particular, was hard on the mega projects. When the oil sands project was considered in 1978, the cost was $6 billion. Last spring, when it was decided by the companies not to go ahead, the cost had increased to somewhere between $13 and $14 billion. Fifth factor would be falling world oil prices. Canadian oil prices were set at are now about 65% of the international price, but under the energy agreement, they can only go to 75%. That's of old oil. But with the falling world oil prices, the new oil reference price, which is found in the energy agreement, is not as high as has been predicted. And finally, there's been a decline in the export of natural gas to the United States. This has affected the cash flow of the natural gas industry. When it introduced the NEP, the federal government assumed, and I think it was correct in its assumption, that there would be some adverse reaction in Western Canada. And in part of the NEP, in the document, it tried to overcome this adverse reaction by, and the quote is, there's a widespread feeling, they recognize, quote, the widespread feeling among people in Western Canada that the region has not shared equitably in the economic benefits of Confederation. This reflects an historic and diverse set of concerns about the influence of transportation facilities and costs, national trade policies and programs, and many other factors bearing on the pace of economic activity in the West. To me, there's a familiar ring there to the types of concerns that were addressed at the WEOC conference, some of the concerns that were addressed in different protest movements. To go on in the National Energy Program, the document, the federal government, to offset this Western hostility, proposed a $4 billion Western Development Fund to be used, quote, for infrastructure improvements in the West, especially in transportation, which was railway upgrading and ports, for industrial development and diversification, and for agricultural and water programs. And to me, there's a clear parallel between what this fund was to be used for and the matters that had been discussed earlier at the Western Economic Opportunities Conference. But what galled many people was that these initiatives were being taken after the federal government had made a major incursion into resource revenues. In effect, the West was being bought with its own money. Despite promises for quick action, the fund did not materialize, and like many other promises, is now forgotten. Indeed, at the time when this fund was supposed to be there, one of our concerns was that every dollar spent in Western Canada would be charged against the fund, and indeed the fund wouldn't be $4 billion, it would be $80 billion, but it would be spent time and time again. And nevertheless, the fund is not there today. What are the consequences of the energy dispute? The consequences, to me, at least, are significant to this discussion we have tonight, and serve to explain why many Westerners believe their interests are being thwarted by federally determined policies. In the 1970s, for the first time in many years, Westerners felt that their future was not only promising, but secure. And the increase in energy prices was seen as an opportunity for the West to develop a solid and a diversified economic base for the future. Optimism and self-confidence, I think, were evident elsewhere, right across Western Canada. When the federal government was seen as changing the rules of the game in the middle of the economic boom, many Westerners felt a sense of deja vu. What's more, the interests of Western Canada were being sacrificed or subordinated to the interests of Central Canada. Two-price system for petroleum, legal challenges to producing provinces, redistribution of resource revenues through new taxes. All these added to their growing sense of distrust. The energy debate also served to increase existing tension between Eastern and Western Canada. If you look at the oil-producing and gas-producing provinces, they're in Western Canada. So the resource provinces reinforce what had been existing East-West tensions. The BC Minister of Energy stated in 1981, quote, BC had every reason to look forward to an energy-secure future before the NEP was unilaterally imposed on the provinces. Now many provincial proposals have stalled because the federal demand for increased revenue and control has changed the rules of the game. Premier Blakeney of Saskatchewan put it even more bluntly. Quote, if you're going to share nationally the benefits of provincial resources, why just Western resources? There's not a two-price system for gold, for nickel, for iron, electricity, nor were there special taxes that had been developed, such as there had been in the oil and gas area. In short, there was a strong conviction that the West was being discriminated against, with this interest being subordinated to those of Central Canada. As a result, the NEP left a legacy of bitterness and distrust. This legacy, coupled with the current economic circumstances, have, to me at least, heightened the sense of alienation throughout Western Canada. That's the energy argument. In tandem with the energy argument was the constitutional debate. The constitutional debate is one which has gone on for some time, but the particular debate which I'd like to comment on was the one that took place throughout 1980 and 81. And again, with the energy question, the debate intensified after federal-provincial discussions and unilateral federal action in the fall of 1980, when the federal government decided that it had had enough of discussions with the provinces and would attempt to patriate and to bring home the Constitution by itself. And at the outset, three of the four western provinces, British Columbia, Alberta, and Manitoba, opposed this action. They were joined by Saskatchewan a few months later. The four western provinces were not alone in this. They were joined with by Quebec, Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, and Newfoundland, and the eight provinces were called the Gang of Eight. And for 1 year, 1980, they were chaired by Premier Lyon of Manitoba, and in 1981, they were chaired by Premier Bennett of British Columbia. The centerpiece of the provincial strategy was a court challenge. And the question was the federal government acting constitutionally, and could it do this? And without going into a long series of detail, the question finally was heard by the Supreme Court in the spring of 1981. And on September 28, 1981, the Supreme Court of Canada brought down its decision. And they found the federal government's actions technically legal. Namely, there's nothing in the existing Constitution saying you can't do it. But the court also ruled that the federal governments were unconstitutional in the conventional sense. And to the court, the Constitution of Canada, using the term in a small c sense, consisted of both a written and an unwritten part, based on conventions. And the court recognized that by acting unilaterally, the federal government was violating the conventions of the Constitution that had developed up to that time. And to me, the judgment confirmed and recognized the federal nature of Canada. And it stressed that the court didn't go as far as to say what majority was needed or how many provinces, but in the judgment it said, they noted that two provinces supported the federal action. They said, that won't pass muster. That's just not enough. But they wouldn't go as far as to say, well, what would the total number require? The final constitutional agreement was reached just over a year ago. Indeed, at this time, was being debated in the Parliament of Canada before going to the United Kingdom. And the constitutional agreement, which was finally developed, to me represented a major gain for Western Canada in one part, particularly the mending formula. The formula that is now in the Canadian Constitution was one that was developed in Western Canada, and it's premised on provincial equality. The formula that it replaced, the one preferred by the federal government, was one which gave Ontario and Quebec, doesn't mention them by name, it says any province which has or had 25% of the population at the time of this enactment, and that covers both Ontario and Quebec, would be given perpetual vetoes. And the Western provinces argued that any amending formula which had to be developed was one that could not distinguish between first and second class provinces. I think it's also of interest, I've mentioned the federal challenges to Saskatchewan legislation. Constitution Act 1982 contains the very first amendment to the Constitution of Canada, which in any way changes through an increase provincial legislative responsibilities. The changes in the area of natural resources and the two changes that were introduced overturned or amend the Constitution to overturn the two Supreme Court of Canada decisions which had gone against the province of Saskatchewan. To this point, I've talked about resources, I've talked about the Constitution. there's another dimension I would like to explore, and that is the political dimension. Coincident with the debates on resources in the Constitution was a decline in the support of the Liberal Party across Western Canada. In the 1979 federal election, the Liberals lost 10 seats in Western Canada and managed to elect only 3 MPs, one from British Columbia and 2 from Manitoba. In 1980, that number was reduced by one-third. There were only 2 MPs from Western Canada, both from Manitoba. For the first time that I'm aware of, at the provincial level for the Liberal Party has fallen off dramatically in all 4 Western provinces, so that today there's not one single Liberal MLA elected in Western Canada. When the federal government initiated the NEP, many observers thought, you know, if you look at this, consider at this situation, that they had written the West off politically, or as being politically insignificant. The sympathetic and cooperative, let's hear your concerns approach, which was demonstrated after the 1972 election, had been replaced by one of unilateral action and apparent indifference to Western concerns. All these factors, including the lack of representation, and I suppose one might also argue that the results of the election in 1980 exacerbated this feeling, contributed to a growing sense of frustration and alienation in Western Canada. Indeed, in March 1981, the Canada West Foundation poll found that 36% of Westerners agreed with the following statement, quote, "Western Canadians receive so few benefits from Confederation that they might as well separate." That's 36% of respondents agreed with that sentiment. Moreover, 61% of Westerners agreed with the statement that, quote, "the West has sufficient resources to become independent." If you take these responses at their face value, the preconditions for the formation of a significant separatist movement were perceived to exist. This perception was reinforced by the emergence at that time of a number of separatist parties and organizations, the two most prominent of which are or were WestFed and the Western Canada Concept. But there are other groups such as the Rupert's Land Independence League. There's a wide range of names that have been developed. In January 1981, WestFed held a number of rallies. The rallies in Vancouver, Edmonton, and Weyburn, Saskatchewan attracted well over 1,000 people each and were the topics of considerable discussion and debate. The size of the crowds was taken to be very significant and gave the impression that a major political upheaval was taking place across Western Canada. The 1982 Olds-Didsbury by-election added further evidence that the separatist tide was rising. But was it really doing that? The same March 1981 poll, which found 36% of Westerners believing Western Canadians may as well separate, there's another question in the poll. It also reported that a significantly smaller percentage, 13%, wanted to separate. So to me, it appears that the desire to separate is not that great, despite disenchantment with the federal government. So there's two separate things here: disenchantment with the system, but not a very strong desire to separate. And to me, the recent provincial election in Alberta suggests that the separatist issue was not taken seriously by the voters. Prior to the election, the Western Canada Concept, which ran candidates in 78 of 79 constituencies, had to come to terms with the issue of separatism. This was prior to the election a few weeks ago. With the result that, if anything, they tried to rid themselves of the image of being a separatist party. The campaign literature of the WCC stressed, quote, "they were working for effective representation and equality for all," and that's in capital letters, "all Canadians." And their literature contained the following statement: "all Canadians, ?" How can we make that claim as separatists? because the vote for the WCC is not a vote for separation. Independence is not an end in itself, but a means to an end. And that's in block letters. Political power in Canada today is used in a way that is basically unfair to the West. The WC is questioning that power and demanding that it be changed. We believe all Canadians are entitled to representation through an effective Senate elected by region, fair and equal taxation without discrimination against region or resource. For these reasons, we are the only party that is truly addressing Canada's problems. Now, if you read the campaign literature, to me, that does not sound much like a separatist movement. The emphasis is on Canada and on being Canadian. Indeed, during the election, there were instances shown on news programs showing candidates running under the WCC banner, tacking Canadian flags to their campaign headquarters. And so, I mean, there was a strong attempt to identify with Canada and things Canadian. And they recognized that while people were concerned with the federal system, they were unwilling to abandon it. When the ballots were counted, the WCC collected 11% of the popular vote, and its only sitting member was defeated. And while it's possible that the WCC in Alberta will continue to exist, I doubt that it will pursue the path of separatism. Indeed, a week ago today, the party leader indicated that the party, if it was to be successful at the polls, and that is one of the objectives of political parties, must reject separatism. So it would seem to me that that issue is one that has been settled for the time being in Alberta. The question then is, where do we go from here? What does the future hold for Western Canadians? And how can the role in Canadian federalism be enhanced? Now, it's clear that the resolution of the problems of Western alienation and Western representation, or the lack of it, will take time and patience to solve. I'd like to stress that. These problems have been a long time in the making, and they will take time and patience to solve them. The answer to the question, what does Western Canada want, is clear, but the solutions are different. They're difficult. To me, though, the fact that the question of, well, what are Western Canadian concerns, is reminiscent of the debate a few years ago, well, what does Quebec want? And at least we have people's attention today. To me, the answer is surely that Western Canadians want to be part of the mainstream of decision-making process in Canada, both economically and politically. Far from wanting to get out of Canada, Western Canadians want to get into Canada. And that, to me, has been one of the continuing themes that has come up in much of the debate in the past. While this is not a particularly new revelation, immediate and quick solutions do not come readily to mind. One that does come to mind is Senate reform. I'm not suggesting this because it was in the WCC platform. It was there as an issue or as a possible solution before that. While I don't want to get into the question of Senate reform tonight, there's no doubt that this is one possible solution. And it's one that has been recognized by groups as diverse as the Canadian Bar Association, the Pepin-Robarts Task Force on National Unity, the Quebec Liberal Party, the Beige Paper, the federal government in its own constitutional proposals in 1978, and both the British Columbia and Alberta governments, as well as the Ontario government. All of these proposals on Senate reform, they're different, but they all have one thing in common, and that is that somehow regional representation must be improved in the center. And somehow we have to get our hands around this issue and develop a better way of strengthening and improving regional representation. The marvel and success of the Canadian federal system has been its ability to cope and adapt with new situations. The mechanism which has permitted this adaptation has been a key forum for negotiation, discussion, and compromise as being federal provincial conferences. Senate reform must be put in that context where it becomes a permanent forum for dialogue and discussion of regional concerns. It's to me a mechanism for ensuring ongoing intergovernmental dialogue will allow in some way for more effective and more continuing solutions to our problems. Senate reform, though, is not a panacea for expressing regional interests. My guess is that the people of Western Canada will continue to search for and to elect strong provincial governments to reflect and represent their interests, to express themselves on certain national issues, whether it's an expansion of port facilities, the continuation of via rail service, tariff rates, or the export of natural gas. The fact of the matter is that provincial governments have become effective and important spokesmen for asserting regional interests and concerns. And to this extent, they've become an effective counterbalance to the federal government, not for the purpose of undermining it, but for the purpose of expressing a provincial or regional perspective on a wide range of policy questions. And this type of exchange, which we see surfacing at WEOC, my guess is that it will continue in the future. I cannot stand here and fearlessly predict that Western alienation will disappear. But I do believe that the resource base of Western Canada, be it renewable or non-renewable, is such that it gives over the long run, not perhaps today, given our current economic circumstance, but over the long run, the resource base gives Western Canada a key factor in securing its economic future. And it will give it a significant role for shaping Canada and helping shape Canada's future economic development. If I am correct, the West's influence over time should increase considerably. The other side, though, is that the political question of representation has to be addressed. Whatever the future holds, one thing is clear, and that is that the separatist alternative is not one that Western Canadians will embrace. Thank you very much.
Dr. Makison has consented to answer questions. If you could pose those to him now, please.
If you'd repeat the question.
The question is, how many years did Central Canada pay over the world price for Western crude while the oil and gas industry was developed in Western Canada? If you take from the time of the creation of the Borden Commission and the Borden Line in early 1960 to the uniform price being established, that would be 14 years. And the price at the pump would have been approximately, I don't have the figures before me, 1 or 2 cents a gallon. This argument or question has been raised on a number of occasions with Alberta. People saying, well, what are you complaining about? After all, we subsidized your oil, and it was then about $2.20 a barrel for some time. In fact, the subsidy, depending on how you look at the question, wasn't that great, if in fact it existed at all. And that is because if you take into account quality of oil, the medium light oils that were being sent to Western Canada, compared with the oil that was coming into the eastern refineries, the Western Canadian crude was a better quality. And today, commands a higher price than oils with, say, a higher sulfur content. So on a quality basis, the price, there was no subsidy at all. But on a per barrel basis, the cost of Western crude was slightly higher, yes. So it would be about 14 years. Yes, sir.
Why is it that Central Canada can control immigration while the Western provinces have no say in about it whatsoever?
The question is, why does Central Canada control immigration and the provinces have no say in it whatsoever? Actually, under the Constitution, immigration is a concurrent matter. But along with agriculture, the two of them are mentioned in the same part of the Constitution. The answer is that by and large, the federal government, through the Immigration Act, has virtually controlled the total field. Now, the federal government does and has entered into with Quebec and one or two other provinces, not just Quebec, has entered into an immigration agreement where the provinces can get more involved in the question of immigration. And on things such as refugees and quotas on refugees, there has been discussion with the federal government. But by and large, the answer is that the federal government has its legislation controls the field. And that leaves the provinces little room to exercise any jurisdiction at all.
But isn't it that Quebec will only take whoever they want, and the other provinces, they will have to accept what is given to them?
No, that's not quite. Not a question of accepting who is given to them. People immigrating to Canada can settle pretty well anywhere where they want. But Quebec, through this immigration agreement, is more active in recruiting immigrants. And they have, I can't tell you how many they have, but they do have personnel in various Canadian consulates and embassies overseas who are actively recruiting immigrants. But the total number of immigrants to Canada is set by the government of Canada. But it's not a question of Quebec doing one thing and the rest of it doesn't quite work that way.
If the Senate is to be set up, is it going to be set up on a population basis for regional representation, or will it be set up on a square mile basis?
If the Senate is set up or modified or reformed, the question is, what is the basis of representation? Is it on population, region, or square mile, square kilometer, or metric? That's smaller unit. The answer is clearly that the province will become the unit of representation. At the moment, the province is, you've got two units of representation in the Constitution Act. One, the region, so that the idea that of equally balanced senatorial regions, the West, which has 24 senators, Ontario 24, Quebec 24, and Atlantic Canada, which has 30, because when Newfoundland came in, they got six more senators. So you have that. But to me, all the Senate reform discussions have focused on the province as the unit of representation. The question then comes down, should they be represented equally, such as they are in the United States and Australia, or should there be some weighting based on population? But there's no suggestion to be weighted on, say, on a geographic side.
Divided equally amongst adopt the population vote directly rather than have the government or the province select the senators?
The question is, if they're to be divided equally, or really, if I can add to the question, if there is to be Senate reform, should the new body, or whatever it's called, should the members be elected or appointed by the provinces? And that, of course, is one of the key debating points. In the United States, they're elected, and it's equality. In Australia, they're elected. In Canada today, they're appointed. And most of these reform proposals have, in fact, all of them have called for, well, not, no, most of them, have called for a provincially appointed Senate or provincial participation in the appointment process. And what you get here, and to me it's, you're really addressing a critical question. Are you reforming the Senate to reform the federal system, which is the thrust of the argument here, somehow regional representation, or are you reforming the Senate to somehow reform the parliamentary system? Well, I'm not sure that Senate reform will accomplish both. And so if one argues for an elected Senate, which people argue for because of the democratic principle, the question comes down to, does that really address the problems of regional representation? And there is no ready answer to that. Some people say it does, some people say it doesn't. And the proof of the pudding, of course, is to determine by what happens after such reform takes place. Most of the reform proposals, the two models you get into, one is the American model, which is elected, originally appointed, of course, and the German model, which is provincially or state appointed. And that, where you get variants, where partly elected, partly appointed, or partly elected, and there's a private bill before the House of Commons now where you get into elected and appointed. The question is, would the WCC have received a larger percentage of the popular vote if they had strictly adhered to a separatist platform? I can't say. My guess is no. That clearly, if they were campaigning way out, knocking on doors, they were saying they were getting some kind of response from the electorate, which said, well, drop that, and maybe, because that change took place, you could see the change, where the debate took place before the election, the change took place during the election, that soft peddling, and subsequent to the election, of course, you've had the leader saying, we've got to drop that if we want to get people elected. And of course, there is a difference between a general election and a by-election. And there's a complete difference between what that represents. Well, yes, except the wrong advice at the wrong time. That may very well be the case, but the fact of the matter is that in February 1982, a person committed to that philosophy was elected. And that was not in question at that time. 9 months later, that same person has said, we must reject that if we want to gain office. So all I'm saying is that that's a sudden conversion. David. The question is, to what extent was the National Energy Program and the constitutional action aimed not so much at the Western provinces, but at all provinces? And does this suggest a new combative attitude on the part of the federal government? And if so, why? That's three questions. That's sneaky. You didn't even get supplementaries. The answer, I think you can make that argument with respect to the Constitution. Clearly, in the back of the federal government's mind is the question of Quebec vis-a-vis the Constitution. On the other hand, the constitutional agreement that went forward or was tabled in Parliament at the time was with the amending formula, was one designed to I think obtained support of, or reflected concerns of Quebec and Ontario in the amending formula. The resource part in the resolution was not put in at the outset. It came in later. And indeed, it came in at the urging of the Federal New Democratic Party, the members in Parliament, who said, look, we have to put something in this package for Western Canada. And that's what they had been pushing for in the constitutional discussions up to that point. Let's put that in. That might satisfy them. The resource thing, I don't think so. Because we talk about resources, but let's take that word and put it aside. One is really talking about oil and gas. One did not find the great national debate on gold, and gold at that time was taking off into the ionosphere, $1,000 an ounce. But no two-price system there. Nor had there been the great debate on electricity or special taxes on electricity, which might have, wouldn't have upset only BC Hydro, but I think Ontario Hydro, Quebec Hydro might have been a little exercise. The one resource area, of course, which is different and where the federal government has exercised vast control, of course, is uranium. But that's more because of defense and strategic concerns emanating from the Second World War and the Atomic Energy Control Act of 1947. Does it represent a more combative mood? I think it does, very much. And the unilateral action, I think, precipitated, well, as I mentioned, a legacy of bitterness and distrust. And the fact, of course, is that in the so-called NEP update, which came out last spring, the Government of Canada backed off much of the policy that it had established in the original NEP, as it did in the energy agreements between Alberta, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, and the federal government. Namely, the position of the NEP that were found in the 1980 document is not what we see today. And the conclusion I would draw from that is that, or one conclusion I would draw from that is that the federal government realized that it had made a mistake. And indeed, to develop the energy sources or resources of Canada does require cooperation with the provinces. But the rest of your question about is this a new mood, I think very clearly it is in the area of federal-provincial relations. Over the next few years, months, and we're going beyond, of course, the West now, but it's very important to the West, I think you will see an ongoing debate over the economic basis of the federal system in Canada, and where you will, if you want to look for something to start on, to search for this debate, there's a number of places. One, in the constitutional discussions that took place in the summer of 1980, one agenda item that had not been discussed in previous discussions was what was called powers over the economy. And I chaired the committee of officials that looked at that, and it had a wide range of questions from marketing legislation, mobility of goods and people and capital, and it was a fascinating discussion. Moreover, the government of Canada was well prepared to discuss it and published a number of documents on economic union. And if you look at statements by the Prime Minister at the time, he talked about, he compared Canada with the European Community and how Canada could not do certain things that the European Community could do. So we had to get Canada at least up to that level. Now, I don't know whether he did either the community or Canada justice, but that's beside the point. The Royal Commission, now that matter did not get put into the Constitution Act 1982. The Royal Commission announced a couple of weeks ago, if you look at the terms of reference for that Royal Commission on the economy, and it's got a longer title than that, but it's the one chaired by Donald MacDonald. If you read the terms of reference, my guess is that the issue of powers over the economy may, and I can't say will, but may be addressed by that Royal Commission. And the parallel between that commission and the Rawls-Thirlwall Commission of the late 30s, one has to compare them, and I can't go to the conclusion that the types of conclusions the new Royal Commission will come to will be similar to those of the Rawls-Thirlwall Commission, but when you look at the terms of reference, because it talks about resource development, talks about the economy and how it should be developed, and there's a directive to the Commission that they must consult with the provinces on these things. It seems to me that will be a major question in the future. And it does tie in with some of the themes of speeches that have been given by the Prime Minister recently, one of which was to, I believe, the Vancouver Club about a year ago today or a year ago tomorrow or yesterday, where he's talking about regional concerns transcending national concerns. So I think it does represent a combativeness, but at the same time, I think that to be successful within the federal system requires cooperation. That's a long answer, but you did ask three questions, but no more supplementaries. The question is, how does Alberta view federally controlled companies such as Petro-Canada and now Dome in terms of provincial oil and gas exploration? Well, it's something that they watch, but that they treat. Of course, the Dome thing hasn't been finalized yet, but taking your question at face value. What they do is they treat them like any other oil and gas company. I mean, they don't say, we won't deal with you. So I think that if they were the only actors in the field, then of course there'd be significant concern. But there are a number of actors in the oil and gas area. So there's been no policy directives on that, or concern, or statements by the government on that. I mean, they do. Petro-Canada can buy and purchase oil, and has a number of leases in the oil sands area, and has talked about constructing an oil sands plant. But they act at the moment as like any other oil company. The Dome one, of course, their activities have been, well, while they are active in Alberta, I mean, Dome has a great deal of activities, of course, in the high Arctic, on so-called federal lands, which, of course, are not a concern to Alberta, where Alberta would have a concern if all federal policies were directed to encourage oil and gas exploration on federal lands as opposed to in the Western Sedimentary Basin, which, of course, spills over into British Columbia, from British Columbia to Manitoba.
Perhaps just one more question.
One right here.
If Ontario and Quebec agree to vote as they have in the past, what chance does Western Canada?
The question is, if Ontario and Quebec continue to vote as they have in the past, what chance does Western Canada? Well, clearly, that's the problem, that the population centers of Canada are in Ontario and Quebec. And Ontario has today 95 seats in the parliament, and Quebec has 75, and Western Canada has 77. So, I mean, the numbers add up, or don't add up, depending on how you look at it. So the answer is to either strong provinces, which act as this counterbalance, or some Senate reform. The creation of a new chamber which acts as a counterbalance to the House of Commons.
Well, are they going to vote to destroy their own vote power?
Oh, sorry, are they going to vote to destroy?
Are they going to, we want them to vote to destroy the power that they have.
Well, well, I suppose
with their
cooperation of their own demise, well, I think you'd have to have a somewhat different stripe or representation in the House of Commons itself. I mean, that would be the first step. If you're talking, but you're not talking, you're talking about the House of Commons. You're not talking about the Senate. Because the Senate, in the amending formula, the Senate can't block any amendment. So Ontario and Quebec, while they have a great deal of weight in the Senate today, the amending formula as written allows for an amendment to be enacted, even if but it has to be repassed by the House of Commons, even if the Senate hasn't agreed to it. So that there is some anticipation that there might be a problem in that quarter. But the issue of representation in the House of Commons itself, of course, is one that can't be altered if one believes in the basic democratic principle of one man, one vote, and representation by population, unless you want to distribute population evenly across Canada, which I doubt that it will take place.
express our gratitude to Dr. Meekeson, I would ask the Deputy Minister of Intergovernmental Relations, Mr. Matkin.
Mr. Justice Traynor, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Meekeson, whether Western Canada was a challenging question, and Dr. Meekeson has met the challenge for us tonight by giving us a coherent presentation with much food for thought. A number of the points, I realize he was not speaking on behalf of the government of Alberta, but I don't think his thoughts are too far away from what might be considered good government policy in Alberta. So I'm going to jump on a couple of points and say that I'm very pleased to see the enthusiasm that he showed for, as he put, very aptly put it, getting more into Canada rather than worrying about getting out of Canada. And I underscore his perception, however, that Senate reform is not a panacea for Western alienation. I think it is useful to recognize that it is, however, a constructive idea that we should be working on, and I'm sure we will be. Dr. Meekeson, I know from personal experience, had much to do with the final success of the Constitution Act 1982, I certainly give him, on your behalf and on my behalf, a warm gratitude for his perceptions tonight, in particular the perception that it was the Supreme Court of Canada who was the centerpiece of the constitutional crisis in terms of its resolution. And I think that is a very, very important understanding. Well, I would simply say this in closing, that I am an enthusiastic tennis adherent, and to give you credit, Dr. Meekeson, I gave up tickets to the Borg-Connors game tonight, and I don't regret it. So thank you very much.